My family was attending an Anderson family reunion the summer I graduated from high school. Reunion headquarters was my aunt's house close to Minneapolis. The little kids were in the backyard playing on the swing set, but my brother and I, teenagers, were standing out front with some of the adults. I found it really interesting when my Aunt Myrna talked about her experience being the first woman president of her board of trustees, or elders, or whatever they called it in her Protestant denomination. She balanced being a strong leader with kindness and understanding. It was a shock, you see, to many of the people that she was the president. Many would have expected her to be at the most secretary and serving the coffee. Her being the first woman president at her local church was big enough news that appeared in her denominational paper, and it made the Minneapolis Tribune. About 30 years later, in 1995, I followed my aunt's footsteps. I was elected president of UUS's Board of Trustees. I was not the first woman by a long shot. There have been lots of women in that role. Much before I was elected, it was normal. I remembered Aunt Myrna's comments and tried to be a strong leader with kindness and understanding. However, I never felt the dynamics of the meeting or any of the interactions were different because I happened to be a woman. The board was thoughtful and tried very hard to handle situations in the best interests of the health of the church as a whole. Our theme for the year was honoring the past and building the future. It was a challenge some months, but I included that phrase in my Unigram article every month. I never did anything without agreement of the board, of course, but as president, you are leader and take the heat for people's concerns. My time as president was rough. You don't need to know all the details here. It was a long, long story. But we had a member that pushed his own agenda and lost track of reasonable boundaries. We even asked for help from a minister from the UCD Pacific Central District who tried to help us mediate, but that didn't even work. Some of what we as a congregation needed to recover from took place during my administration. Interestingly enough, I don't remember those years as only difficult and awful. Maybe kindness and understanding worked, because members returned that kindness. Many encouraged me. No one was hostile or called me horrible, dirty names. I remember one member saying something like, "You know, I was president here years ago, and I never had to deal with anything this difficult. I don't necessarily agree with what you're doing, but I know you are trying hard to do the right thing for the church. Thank you." I couldn't have asked for anything more.
Ever since colonial times in America, women have represented the majority of religious participants in religious communities and institutions. At no point in our history have men ever been in that majority. Religious historian Anne Browdy has written that American religious communities have depended on women's presence, energy, and resources. Even in male-dominated U.S. religious organizations, women's presence has predominated. In recent years, many people have worried or complained about what they thought was a decline in men's participation in congregations. Browdy says, however, that there has been little change. The story to be told is not a decline in men's numerical presence, but the enduring majority of women. She says this is true across denominations of Protestant faiths, in the North and South, white, black, or otherwise. It's true in Roman Catholicism, where there are more sisters in religious orders than there are priests or brothers, not to mention more faithful laywomen than men in parish congregations. To be sure, it is paradoxical that women have sustained religious organizations that excluded them from the clergy and elected lay leadership and even suppressed their voices. Even so, Browdy says, there would be no clergy, no seminaries to train them, no hierarchies to ordain them unless women supported all of those necessary institutions. Women have provided the majority of audiences for preaching, participants for rituals, the material and financial support for religious buildings and operations, and perhaps most important, they have instilled faith in their children. This rings true with my family's religious history. It was women who taught the faith. My mother would be 100 years old this year if she were alive. She was brought up by a mother who was a Christian Scientist. That was a fairly new movement when her mother was growing up. It was started in the 1870s by a woman in Boston named Mary Baker Eddy. Christian Science is a healing, is based on healing through positive thinking, using the Bible as the guide. My mother and her four siblings did not become church-going Christian Science adults. My mother left the church when she married my father and joined Dad's church. It was the church of his childhood. It was in our hometown. It had rough-hewn limestone walls on the outside, big, round, stained glass windows, beautiful, curved, stained dark wood pews, and white people filling all of those pews on Sunday morning. And Mom and I would sit right about there in the third row, well, actually over there, our right side, the third row on the end, almost every Sunday. And Mom would show me how to use the hymnal, and she would show me how to greet the minister in the receiving line after the service. I looked over her shoulder as she would write the check for the offering basket. I recall it was $20, which made an impression on me. And we would talk about church. One Sunday, the minister said something simplistic, and she leaned over to me and made a sarcastic remark. And that got us to giggling, and one of us would stop giggling, and then the other one would get us started again. And we tried really hard to not make any noise, that our bodies were shaking in the pews. And eventually she slipped out until the next hymn and came back. When I was 13, Mom realized that was the typical year when kids would get baptized in our denomination, and so she got on it. Even though I had already missed all but two of the Sunday school sessions to learn about what our faith was all about, I was permitted to go through the baptismal ritual. They would not have said no to Mom. My father attended now and then, including the Sunday of my baptism, but really it was rare that he would come with us. It was the church of his childhood, but he was not the one who made us a church-going family. It was our mother. In every Unitarian Universalist congregation of which I've been a part, female-identified adults have made up the majority of worshipers, volunteers, and elected officers. Browdy, the historian, says there is no need to wring our hands as if there is a problem. It's just the way things are and have been for a long time. No need to cajole those guys who aren't here very often. Yet there is one thing we can do. We could notice those men who are drawn to a UU church and who find value in participating in this community. We could say, I'm glad you're here. I can think of many male-identified UUs who have been devoted, involved, and appreciated members of the church. For example, our men's group meets tomorrow night. This week, our program council will hold a reception to celebrate our grasshoppers. This is our ministry of lawn mowing. While UUSS can boast that we have several women-identified grasshoppers, it was two men who founded it years ago, Claire Ernest and Dave Lust. And at least half of the current volunteers are male-identified. On Thursday at 4, we will honor all our grasshoppers, those people who don't mind getting dirty to make our campus clean and don't mind sweating a little to save us money. In most religions, the most visible positions of leadership are those of ordained clergy. The clergy has been male-dominated for centuries. Our Unitarian Universalist faith tradition has moved faster than other American denominations to ordain women, starting with the Universalist Olympia Brown, who was ordained a pastor in 1863. However, women clergy did not rapidly increase as a share of all the UU ministers until the 1970s. And the past few decades have seen a transformation in Unitarian Universalism. By now, more than half of our UU clergy are female. Women have led some of our largest congregations. I am sure it is thanks to that female courage and feminist progress that now we have many more ministers than we used to who are able to serve openly as lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender ministers. Here at this congregation, we've been a bit slow. Our first ordained female minister was the Reverend Eileen Karpeles, who served us as an interim or transitional minister for a year and a half, starting in 1989. By then, UUSS had been around for 120 years. Later ministers, I can name them all, were the Reverend Rochelle Russell, the Reverend Dr. Shirley Rank, the Reverend Lynn Cox, the Reverend Connie Grant, and the Reverend Sidney Wild. Most of them were part-time clergy, and all were here temporarily, some by plan, but others temporarily by an unexpected or unwelcome turn of events. And I might mention that the UU Community Church of Sacramento, during its 25-plus years of being in this region, had three settled ministers, all of whom were women. So in this congregation, UUSS, the longest-serving female-identified minister in the entire 150-year history is the one we have now, the Reverend Lucy Bunch. She is nearing her five-year anniversary with us. I give thanks for Lucy's gifts. To her efforts and her energy, I attribute much of the success of our building project, our move away and our relocation, the improvement of our staff's performance and morale, our growth in membership and in our diversity, and the vitality of our many programs. She is awesome. Of course, I recruited her, so that makes me brilliant. But this is about women's religious history today. Looking again beyond our denomination, it's amazing that women have accomplished so much in religions that have excluded them from many roles. As Browdy writes, women provide most of the audiences for preaching, participants for rituals, and material and financial support for religious buildings and operations. And women figure out ways to assert their power even when officially denied it. I know a man who serves as a part-time assistant pastor for a conservative Christian denomination. And he told me a story that was very instructive. In the church where he serves part-time, they have a senior pastor, and the senior pastor and his wife moved the pastor's mother from out of town into their town and into their house so that they could all be together and they could care for her. And of course, being a faithful Christian worshiping woman, she did attend her son's church. And one Sunday, that pastor decided that he would try to be a little more cutting edge, try to respond to changes in church styles. And so he went to church and gave his sermon in trousers and a sport coat and an open collared shirt. no necktie. He was wanting to appeal to come across as more approachable and accessible to younger people, perhaps. So by the time that pastor got home that afternoon, his mother had received 17 phone calls from other women in the church going without a necktie is not acceptable. So he heard that verdict and he heeded it that his mother conveyed to him. His experiment ended on the day that it began. So in a congregation, in a community, this humorous story is an example of informal communication, also known as gossip. It is a story of people not speaking directly to the person with whom they have a disagreement, but instead speaking about that person to others. This is called triangulation, and it's dysfunctional. Triangulation is harmful to communities and families. However, it seems to me that in a tradition where the clergy role is denied to people who aren't male, and where even elected roles are denied to people who aren't male, where the pastor is always male and where male authority can't safely be challenged in a direct way, those ladies exercised what power they had. And for them, it was very effective. In U.S. American history, women and other categories of people who are vulnerable and excluded from formal positions of power have been able to establish parallel structures for themselves in order to have an impact, whether that's within an organization or separate from an organization. For example, caucuses by LGBT students on a campus, or by students of color, or professionals of color in a particular field. All can be bases of power and influence. Our congregation's parallel organization for the longest stretch of time in our history is the Unitarian Women's Alliance. The Alliance was founded here in 1911 before we even had a church home. Some women from the church would gather at a member's home for a meeting one morning a week. In a few more decades, Alliance meetings would move to a monthly basis and would take place at the church building as they do today. Women found fellowship with one another as they enjoyed refreshments, as they organized music, literary, and artistic programs for the public, and as they held fundraising events. They shared reviews of new books with one another. They discussed social issues like poverty, education, and public health. In the 1940s and 50s, they talked about world peace and discussed the Charter of the United Nations. Meanwhile, they served meals for church events. They always made money with food. In the early decades of the 1900s, our alliance granted a lot of money to the congregation for church operations. In 1923, for example, the alliance voted to give $868 to the church. The alliance had 241 dues-paying women as members that year. That was five times the number of members in the church itself. I will talk more about the Alliance in the fall when our 150th anniversary team will honor the women with a reception, including snacks made from a California cookbook of 1890. The book says that its recipes were compiled and approved by the ladies of the Unitarian Society. Meanwhile, I hope you can take a look after the service or some other day, I hope you can take a look at the display case that's outside the restrooms over there in the education building. A new Alliance member has made a photo exhibit of the group's high points in history. All through its history, the Alliance has changed with changing times. For example, you don't have to be woman identified to attend its programs now, and it no longer has an extensive committee structure as it did for most of the 20th century. Starting in 1911, our Sacramento Alliance was a dues-paying chapter of the National Alliance of Unitarian Women. It had begun in 1890. Yet the Unitarian women were 20 years behind the Universalists. Having started in 1869, the Association of Universalist Women is believed to be the oldest religious organization of women lay leaders in the country. At the national level, those two groups merged to form the UU Women's Federation in the early 1960s. And by organizing within our denomination's decision-making structure, the Women's Federation was able to bring our attention to gender discrimination and sexism in our larger movement and in our congregations. A major milestone in liberal religious history in this country took place in 1977 at a vote at our denominational UU gathering, the General Assembly, or GA. Thanks to years of work by women activists, GA delegates adopted a resolution entitled Women and Religion. This resolution required our denominational administration and urged our congregations to conduct audits for sexism in our institutional processes and structures. The resolution also called on us to avoid sexist assumptions and language in the future. A striking example of such language was the old hymnal. Well, I would hold it up, but it's an old blue hymnal. And I know what's in it, so I don't have to open it. The old blue hymnal was published in 1963. It was still in use in 1977 when that resolution came to the assembly floor. In its hymns and readings that refer to humanity, it says men, mankind, brotherhood, and brothers. Music and readings are divided into topical sections in that hymnal, as they are in the current hymnal, but in that old blue hymnal, there's a whole section of songs under the topic of man. There is always more to learn and more to be done in the area of gender inclusion in our faith tradition. Likewise, we are learning in the present moment from UU leaders of color some of the ways that a dominant culture of whiteness gets in the way of justice and inclusion within our own movement. There is always more to learn and more to be done as we strive to embody our values in our practices. In those years of the Women and Religion resolution, leading up to it and after, there was resistance by some leaders in our denomination to the cause for change. Resistance, impatience, unkindness, harumphing, eye-rolling. But now in hindsight, many of those changes appear to be no big deal anymore. Yet they were a big deal. The uncertainty of change can cause discomfort or fear, especially if you have gotten used to things being done in certain ways or spoken about in certain ways. Yet in a congregation that is growing in size, in diversity, and in awareness, an aspect of church life that may not suit the taste of one person could be just what a new person needs to feel acknowledged, welcomed, and at home. For some of us, choices or changes in language or processes are matters of taste or comfort. But they are bigger matters, greater matters for people who are marginalized. That is, for people whose identities mean that they have less power and more vulnerability, those same changes in language or processes could be matters of spiritual survival. This coming Thursday, when we celebrate our Grasshopper volunteers, Thursday is the anniversary of our founding, March 29, 1868. To those original 17 families who came together in Sacramento and signed their names, to them this was a liberal Christian church. The mission of their church was, quoting now, "the worship of God and the service of men." Now, 150 years later, this is a congregation of various religious perspectives and various genders and gender expressions and other kinds of diversity held together by our values and our covenant. Since 2001, the mission of UUSS has read, "We come together to deepen our lives and to be a force for healing in the world." This is the same congregation, but it is a new congregation. You make it new by your presence. You make it new every moment. We have cause for deep gratitude for the people now among us and those who came before us, those of all genders and all ages, those who have embodied our congregation and our faith. May we be ever grateful as we carry it forward. So may it be. Blessed be.